year, I was thinking about our time in Roswell, and it dawned on me that we were both, Carrie and I were both 26 years old when we came over here. And at the time, we didn't have any kids. We'd been married for about 2.5, almost 3 years. I had just graduated from LCU, and this was my first opportunity to minister. And I want you to know that anytime I get a chance to tell people about my experience here at Country Club Road, I always make a point to tell them that that church loved us well. They did. They loved us well. And I just want to say that, you know, I'm getting to the age now where I am starting to repeat stories and repeat things that I've said in the past, but I reserve the right to say things over and over when I come here because I don't get to do that very often. This church means a lot to us. And that was our first opportunity to serve in ministry. And it set a very good tone for what has now been, believe it or not, 26 years since we were here. So we got here, Kent, when we were 26, and it's been 26 years since we moved here. You're going to see some images up on the screen here in just a moment of some familiar people. Some of them are people that you know because you go to church with them, or maybe you've gone to church with them. Some of them are you're going to recognize because they're celebrities, and I only have one task for you. All I want is your first impression. So what is not required of you is critical reflection. So I think that's pretty easy. And so, Lindsay, if you will, give me the first image. I think everybody knows who Dick Van Dyke is. That the man is still alive. He's 99 years old. And I put pictures of him when he was young and when he's an older gentleman here because what you see there on the left, I think he is still just as vibrant as he was when he was active. Next person. I was just a young guy when Jimmy Carter was the president. I don't know a whole lot about him, and I don't know what your first impression of him is, but the first thing I think of is what I probably was told or overheard from family, which is, really good human being, maybe not one of the best presidents that we've had. I don't know. That's what I've heard. Next person. I don't know if all of you know who this person is. That is Olivia Perkins. And she grew up at this church. And I'll just tell you, I got out of here before she got in the youth group. She actually now lives in Lubbock. And that little girl there texted me about a month ago on a Saturday when Texas Tech was playing football. She texted me from inside a luxury box, and she said, "I bet you're not watching the game from a luxury box. I bet you're probably down in the cheap seat with all the other people, all the other unwashed masses." I'm not sure who raised that girl, but I don't know what your first impressions are, but she's a pill. And then the next one. I have a first impression that I'd like to share of Lee. When we were talking back and forth on the phone, I talked to several people from Country Club Road, and Lee saw fit to come and visit me in Lubbock. And I know you remember this. Surely you remember this. He came to my place of employment, which was Bailey's Bookstore in Lubbock, and I took my break when he came in. We went back, and we sat in the break room. And he began to ask questions. We're just trying to get to know each other. And it was the first time I experienced Lee Rogers, you know, where he would ask you a question, you'd answer, and he'd just stare a hole right through me. I was scared to death. That man could have told me, "You are moving to Roswell." And I'd have said, "Yes, sir. How fast?" "I will do whatever you say, sir, if you just let me out of here." All right, next ones. We're just going to go quickly. I think everybody knows Julie Andrews. First impressions. Next one. Abram and Sarah. What is your impression of the biblical characters, Abram and Sarah? That's who we're going to talk about this morning. I want to talk about these two people for a few moments this morning. And I have very little doubt that most of you probably have pretty good impressions of these two heroes of faith, basically, is what they are. But I also have a feeling that if you were to ask them, if they were here this morning, they would probably say, like a lot of us, like me, like Lee, like Olivia, like some of these others, you may have a really good impression of me, but if you only knew. And I have the strong feeling that if Abraham and Sarah were sitting right here on the front pew, they would say, if you only knew. And the problem for them is that we do know, because we have the biblical record. It's likely that most of us gravitates towards thinking of them as good, holy, righteous, and they were. We don't gravitate towards a thing in the scriptures that might not paint such a good light of them. So I would like to talk about them and a story that they're involved in from Genesis chapter 16. If you'd like to go ahead and open up, we're going to read from there in just a moment. But I'd like to talk about Abraham and Sarah and their story. So who are they? Well, they are among the first major characters developed in the Old Testament, in the Bible. Abraham is considered the father of Judaism, having received what I would consider to be the calling of all callings in Genesis chapter 12, in which he was asked to leave his homeland and all of his people in Ur, and as the scripture says, go to the land I will show you, where I will make you into a great nation, bless you, make your name great, and where all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. And what did they do? They did. They did exactly what God asked them to do. In obedience and in faith, they left their homelands, they packed up all the U-Haul trucks, they got the family, and they left. And faithful as they were, they did everything God asked. And so that was not enough. I want you to think about the heroes of faith section in Hebrews chapter 11. There again, we have an opportunity to begin to develop favorable impressions of these two people. If you think about it, in Hebrews chapter 11, Abraham is praised for multiple demonstrations of his faith in 8 verses. That is significantly more than any of the other 17 people that are mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11, more than Moses. You should have a favorable impression of Abraham and Sarah. They played significant roles in biblical history. One of the most vital roles in God's plan of redemption in creating a faith legacy that would one day deliver the Messiah to all people throughout all time. That said, I will say this. There are other stories besides Abraham's calling in Genesis chapter 12, or the story in which he takes Isaac up the hill because God has told him to sacrifice his son, and he's going to do it because what? He's a faithful man. There are other stories about Abraham and Sarah, cautionary tales, that maybe demonstrates that God is using, after all, human beings. And maybe we shouldn't exalt human beings too highly. And there's no biblical narrative that is more humbling for two heroes of the faith than the one that we find in Genesis chapter 16. So, I'm going to read, I think, through verse 16 or 17. So, let's begin in verse 1. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, well, she had not been able to bear children for him. But she had an Egyptian servant named Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, The Lord has prevented me from having children. So go and sleep with my servant. Perhaps I can have children through her. And Abram agreed with Sarai's proposal. So Sarai took Hagar, the Egyptian servant, and gave her to Abram as a wife. By the way, this happened 10 years after Abraham had settled in the land of Canaan. Abraham had seen a lot that God had done in the 10 years before this began. This takes place. So Abram had sexual relations with Hagar. She became pregnant. But when Hagar knew that she was pregnant, she began to treat Sarah with contempt. And then Sarai said to Abram, hey, this is all your fault. I put my servant into your arms, but now that she's pregnant, she treats me with contempt. The Lord will show who's wrong, you or me. And Abraham replied, look, she's your servant, so deal with her as you see fit. And then Sarai treated Hagar so harshly that she finally just ran away. And the angel of the Lord found Hagar beside a spring of water in the wilderness along the road to Shur. And the angel said to her, Hagar, where have you come from and where are you going? I'm running away from my mistress, Sarai, she said. And the angel of the Lord said to her, you return to your mistress, Sarai, and you submit to her authority. And then he added, I will give you more descendants than you can count. And the angel of the Lord said, you are now pregnant, and you will give birth to a son, and you are to name him Ishmael, which means God hears. For the Lord has heard your cry of distress. And then, therefore, after Hagar used another name to refer to the Lord who had spoken to her, and she said, you are the God who sees me. Have I truly seen the one who sees me? So the well there was named Beer Lahai Roy, which means well of the living one who sees me. So Hagar gave Abram a son, and Abram named him Ishmael. Abram was 86 years old when Ishmael was born. I wonder if you didn't have the biblical record, if you didn't have all of the good stories, if all you had was Genesis chapter 16, I wonder what you would have thought of Abraham and Sarah then. If we didn't know they were two of Israel's most famous and most religious figures, two of Israel's most honored characters, what would you think of these people if all you had was this chapter? Well, the problem is we do have this chapter. We have to grapple with it. We have to wonder, why did they behave the way that they behave? So I want to dig into this text. And I want to ask, what are we supposed to do with this story? How do we reconcile what we know about Abraham and Sarah with the bad behavior that we're seeing here in Genesis chapter 16. And what I want to do is I want to dig into the characters, the three main characters, which is Abraham, Sarah, and Hagar. And let's start with the mistress. That's what Hagar would have called her. Let's start with Sarah. From the very first verse, I'm just going to say this. It's hard for me not to feel just a little bit sorry for Sarah. Think about the opening line that we just read. Now, Sarai, Abram's wife, think about this. Well, she had not been able to bear children for him. I don't know how you read that, but to me that sounds a little bit more like a criticism, more like an indictment of guilt or maybe failure than it does a statement of fact. I realize I'm reading this story with Western eyes. The last time I checked, women have very little to say about whether they can have children. Women have very little to say as to whether they can have a male or female child. It's not a given. It's biology. You don't get to choose. Some people can have children quickly. Some people try and they're not able, and so they adopt. Sarah had no more control over biology than Abraham, and yet it seems that the writer is accusing her, not him, of just not doing the job that an orthodox Hebrew male would have expected his wife to do. What we see here, I think, is a mindset, a paradigm that was pretty prevalent in Hebrew culture that presumed that the best wives are the wives that could bear lots and lots of children for their husbands, especially that could bear lots and lots of sons for their husbands. The others, what about the others? Are they to be thrown out? Are they incapable? Are they incompetent? It does seem that the presumption at the time was that if a woman could give or could not give birth to a child for her husband or give her husband a son, that she was not very much use to him. How else is a man supposed to build a legacy? How else is a man supposed to carry on the family name, provide security for those that he loves, if his woman doesn't give him kids, sons especially? Before we talk about Sarah anymore, let's just take a minute to consider what kind of social or cultural, even personal pressures that women back in those days must have endured because of these kinds of mindsets. I think that we can safely assume that there was a lot of pressure on women back in those days. And I think that we could assume that before Sarah even got word that she was going to have a child, that she was promised to have a child, I have a feeling that she probably, like a lot of her contemporaries, stressed about being able to give Abraham a son, and therefore a family, therefore a legacy. And so what I think you might see from Sarah's subsequent behavior in this chapter, while it's not excusable, might certainly be attributed to the personal and the cultural pressures that just harassed her and that just dogged her for years and years. Can you imagine being a woman during Old Testament days and thinking the family lineage depends on me? It depends on me. That is a lot of pressure for a lady. And then let's talk about her subsequent behavior. What are we to make of it? Well, I think we can all agree that it was rough. I think the way that she behaved was wrong, showed immaturity, especially for a woman who I think is about 75 years old here at the time and who had also had divine encounters with God. If I had had some divine encounters, if I had gotten to stand outside the door and hear God tell my spouse that you're going to have a child at 75 years old, and then it happens, I'd believe anything that he said. And I would try to behave exactly like him, good like him. But in this account, Sarah comes across as bitter. She comes across as moody and as calloused. And I'm just going to say, I think she comes across as fairly mean in this text. And like Eve, she's not above casting blame. She really casts blame at everybody in the whole story, really except for herself. She says, the Lord, she even blames God, the Lord has prevented me from having children. And then she says to Abraham, this is all your fault. I put my servant into your arms and now she treats me with contempt. Who'd have thunk, right? And as a direct result of her harsh behavior, what happens? Hagar, pregnant, alone, disillusioned, afraid, scared, and exposed. She's driven out. She goes out into the desert and runs away. And what about the fella here? What about the fella in this story? What about the dude? I got to stop here for just a minute and tell you about one of my teachers when I was in Houston, South Houston Bible Institute. His name was G.B. Shelburne. And every time one of us young preacher students would get to speak at church, he would take index cards and he would make notes. And he would try his hardest to write nice things about us. You know, it's kind of hard for some of us when we were 18, 19 years old, you know. And then he would give us those notes after we got down. Well, one day I got down from preaching on a Wednesday night and he handed me his note and he went over with me. And the note had some nice things in it, but it also said something like this. When speaking about the disciples, I would refrain from referring to them as those guys. I would refrain from calling them those guys. Those are the apostles that the Lord chose, and they deserve more respect than to be called those guys. So I'm telling you that because I don't think GB would appreciate me calling the father of Judaism, one of the most famous characters in the Old Testament, a fella or a dude or a bruh. But you know what? When I look at his behavior in this section, I think that's what he acts more like. He acts more like just a fella, a dude, than he does a grandfather who is there for his family, who is solid, who is constant, who is nurturing, the patriarch of the family. I don't see a man who's acting like the patriarch of the family. He's not characterized especially favorable in the story, just like Sarah wasn't. Actually, the image painted of him is quite unfavorable, maybe even a bit stereotypical when you think about what some people think of just guys in general. I may be overthinking it. I may not understand the cultural well enough to totally get it, but one could argue that Abraham, amid all of the drama, seems just a little bit too nonchalant, just a little too disconnected, unconcerned about what's going on under his own roof. Sarah says, "Abram, go and sleep with your servant. Perhaps I can have children with her." And the writer tells us, Abram agreed with Sarai's proposal. I'm just going to tell you, I've been in a few business meetings, and what that text right there reminds me of is a business meeting. Somebody making a motion. I make a motion that Sarai give Hagar to Abraham so that we can ensure that we have a lineage and legacy. All in favor? That's what the text says, that he agreed with Sarai's proposal. What is this, a business transaction? Any young couple in this room, and I'm looking at some of you guys out here that I worked with when you were younger, Mac and Anna and some of the rest of you, I know that when you guys went to have kids, that you knew on some level, you had absorbed on some level the seriousness of having children. You probably didn't know everything that you were in for, right? But you knew that it was a serious thing to have kids. You think about it. You pray about it before you do this. But all we get from Abraham in this story is this. Basically, I'm kind of paraphrasing here, but sounds good, send her in. And consider the father of Abraham's, father of Judaism's response amid all the tension and turmoil that's going on under his roof. Two women who are living in opposition to each other. Abraham's contribution to the problem. And if you think about it, this is the first time in the story that we hear him speak. We've heard other people speak up to this point. Now we hear Abraham speak. And he simply says, "Look, she's your servant. You deal with it as you see fit." And I think the Genesis writer forgot to write this down, which is, "and leave me out of it." That's kind of what it sounds like to me. She's your servant. Deal with it. Leave me out of it. And Sarah does. She deals with Hagar so harshly that Hagar flees. Now, forgive me if I expect just a little bit more from a faith hero. The man's 85 years old. He's had a front row seat for at least 10 years, watching God do his thing, deliver Abraham's people across deserts, through droughts, from enemies. I'm wondering, where's this man's strength? Where's the strength that we had come to see in stories like when he's walking up a hill with his son, his only son, he's about to sacrifice him? That takes tremendous faith. Where's that guy? Where's the guy who dropped everything and travels across a land that seems barren and ugly because he trusts God? Where's that guy? What's wrong with Abraham in this story? Is he really that selfish? Is he really self-centered at 85 years old? And then our final character is Hagar. I think Hagar is probably the real casualty in this story. Do you realize that until verse 8, Hagar had not been addressed directly by either Abram or Sarai? Until verse 8, Hagar had been talked about. She had been spoken against. She had had decisions made for her, but she was never addressed directly. She was obviously never consulted regarding important matters that affected her deeply. And immediately, and of course she hadn't, because after all we know, she was only a slave. And as history has told us, what a slave wants is really just pretty irrelevant. And no one knew that more than Hagar did. Probably acquired by Abraham and Sarah when they fled famine to Egypt, Hagar had known servitude for a long, long time, one would assume. Maybe she was the product of her parents' debt. They got so desperate that they had to sell her. Maybe she was the spoil of war in Africa. But she was a human being as much as the next person. And she surely aspired, just like everybody in this room, to a life beyond a slave. Maybe she knew it was not likely, but she no doubt dreamt it. And so it makes a little bit of sense to us, it should, when she does the unthinkable as a slave and she displays contempt for her mistress. Probably something that could have gotten her injured or perhaps even killed. And I don't think that it is so much that she looks down on Sarah because Sarah doesn't have the ability to bear children. It's because Sarah threatened her dreams. It becomes so clear here in this text that Hagar, though just a slave, also had dreams, also had aspirations. It was crystal clear what she wanted more than anything in the world when the angel of the Lord comes to her and in verse 9 says this, "Hagar, return to your mistress, submit to her authority," and then here it is, "and I will give you more descendants than you can count." Hagar simply desired what probably most people, most Hebrew women back in those days desired. She wanted a family. She also wanted a legacy. She wanted to create security for the people that would come in her wake when she was no longer there. And she revolted only when she realized that Sarah didn't see her. Sarah did not see her. Sarah saw a means to an end. She did not see a person. She saw basically a pawn on a chessboard, somebody that she could move around and do whatever she wanted with to secure her own legacy and her own dreams. And she was going to take Hagar's child. It's interesting what happens to a person when he or she doesn't feel seen. It's interesting to see what happens to a person when he or she does not feel seen. That's really what this story, I think, is about. A royal couple and an invisible woman. One of the biggest issues in our society, yet probably one of the least addressed, is loneliness. I don't have to tell you all what loneliness is. I know that all of you in here have experienced it. Some of you have experienced it more than others. Loneliness often has little to do with the number of people that you share space with. In fact, loneliness is more prevalent when a person is in large crowds, like what we are here this morning. Being alone in a mountain cabin or in your tent or in your RV or in your study reading a book, that's called solitude. I try to get solitude a few times a year by going camping, going into the mountains. Anybody prevents me from doing that, I will fight them for solitude. Solitude and loneliness are not the same things. Loneliness is when a human being feels isolated with their stress and their insecurities. Loneliness is feeling like no one sees you or sees your situation, sees what you're going through, what's going on behind the smile, behind the facade. It's feeling misunderstood or maybe not even understood at all. And loneliness is often paired with some bad partners, some bad companions, fear and pride, which when they are allied causes the lonely person to recede, like Hagar did, into dark places, places that are not healthy to be in. And there you are vulnerable to those thoughts that come into your mind because the devil lies in wait for you to get there. You're just not a smart person. You're just not as creative as these other people are. You know, you're just kind of average. There's so much more I know. I understand that to this story than what we've been talking about here this morning. But from this particular angle of the story, the Elroy angle, the being able to see angle, I can't help but conclude that this story is a cautionary tale of what happens to people when they aren't truly seen. We run away. We isolate. We try to protect ourselves by going places where we know we won't be hurt by other people or what they're going to say to us. And in so doing, when we do that, we become exposed to other kinds of dangers, to negative self-talk, to lies told by the devil, in those moments of weakness. So, I want to end this morning by asking, what is it that prevented Abraham and Sarah, these two really godly people, from seeing this hurting woman and really from seeing themselves? How could two otherwise really good human beings have been reduced to such blindness? I don't really think they knew what they were doing. I don't know that they knew that they were hurting Hagar so badly. And how is it that we can become more like what Hagar calls God, El Roy, than like Abraham and Sarah? You know, Hagar coined a new name for God here in this section, El Roy, the God who sees me. He is the God who sees me. I'm just a slave. I've never mattered at all in my life. I don't even get to dream. Abraham and Sarah, other masters that have presided over me, I'm really nobody. But this God, first one in the story to address Hagar, and the first one in this story to actually see Hagar, she calls him El Roy, the God who sees me. Well, I want to be like that God. And I think that God wants us to be like him. I believe that having the ability to see people and to see them deeply is what God desires of each one of us. I also believe it's not a default mode for us. I don't think it's very easy. I think that what we have here is a story that you have two people, Abraham and Sarah, who were so engrossed in their own situation that they weren't able to see those people around them. That's how we are. We get really engrossed, really wrapped up in what's going on in our lives, our dreams, our troubles, our challenges, and all of those things. They're normal, but it does make it really hard to see outside of our bubbles and see other people. And it's just always going to be that way. We're always going to have challenges. And so how is it that we can be more like El Roy than Abraham and Sarah? I don't know. I don't know the answer exactly to that, but I do know that it at least begins with trying to become more like him, like El Roy. Reading his scriptures, being with his people, spending time in prayer, all those things that condition us to be godly type people. But I also believe that seeing people, really seeing them, is a spiritual discipline. You have to work at it. It does not come naturally for us. And so when you go to work on Monday, or you get up from the pews here this morning, or you go to school tomorrow, open our eyes. Let's open our eyes. And you know, we don't like to bother people. We don't like to get in other people's business, you know. But, you know, it's okay to go up to somebody and say, David, how are you doing? David's going to say, I'm doing fine. Okay. really, how you doing? It's okay to prod. How are you doing? I'm okay. Just okay? Well, yeah, I'm okay. You're not very convincing. Well, the pregnancy's been hard on us, and, school, there's been some drama at school, and this happened to me a few weeks ago with a young man at our church. And I could have just said, how you doing, Paul? I'm doing all right. Oh, good. I'll see you later. It's okay, people. It's okay, people of God, to prod, to get a little bit up in people's business. Sometimes they kind of welcome it because they're not just going to come out and tell you that they're not doing it because they don't want us to think that we're weak. But we all are there. We all know what it's like. So let's see the world like God sees the world. Let's prod each other. Let's call each other on the phone. Let's send texts. Let's take somebody to dinner, to lunch, and get to know them well and get to know their issues. And maybe in so doing, we can be a blessing to them. And you know what? Maybe in the future, there'll be ones that are a blessing to you. Elroy, the God who sees me. That's who we're trying to be. Again, thank you for letting me be here this morning. It's always an honor and a privilege. I love coming back. If anybody